Hello everyone and welcome to the Smashy Business Show. Today is Wednesday, June 18th, 2025 and I'm Abdul Majid Awan.
And I'm Ward Ahmed and we've got a packed show for you today. We're going to be discussing how the Aramco CEO in Saudi Arabia came out and said that oil and gas are crucial in times of conflict. Secondly, we're also going to be discussing how flight detours and fuel costs have hit Gulf Airlines really hard, and it's also peak travel season. Dubai's Bin Ghati launches $1 billion Sharia-compliant asset management firm, and Iranian State TV has accused WhatsApp of sharing user data with Israel.
And it can't be a show if we don't discuss the Iran-Israel conflict. And Saudi Aramco CEO Amin Nasser, he also threw a little bit of light on it. And he emphasized the crucial role of oil and gas during periods of geopolitical conflict. Speaking via video link at the Energy Asia conference in Kuala Lumpur, Nasser said, energy security is once again a top priority for global leaders.
His comments came just days after oil prices surged in response to renewed conflict in the Middle East, particularly after Israel's unprovoked and illegal airstrikes on Iran. Now, Brent crude jumped sharply following the escalation, highlighting how geopolitical tensions continue to affect global energy markets.
And Nasser argued that oil and gas remain indispensable, especially during crises. He pointed out that while the energy transition is vital, renewables alone cannot yet meet global energy demands, very rightly so. He also cited the cost of reaching net zero emissions as potentially hitting up to $200 trillion, an enormous economic burden.
And his remarks reflect a broader industry sentiment that energy transitions must strike a balance between sustainability, security, and affordability. Now, Nasser's comments suggest that global policymakers may need to reconsider the pace and scale of moving away from fossil fuels and rising geopolitical and economic risks.
And with Middle East tensions far from resolved, oil market volatility is likely to continue. Oil is around 70, 75. It's like switching between these two numbers in there somewhere. So it was 65 at some point. And with Aramco revenues crucial to funding Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030, Nasser's message is clear. Traditional energy sources will remain at the heart of the global mix, even as the world pushes towards decarbonization.
You know, it's so interesting, Majid, about you saying that right now, like oil per barrel, it's around $70 to $75. I remember reading somewhere that for, you know, for the NEOM project to go ahead, for all of Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030 projects to go ahead, they need oil to be $80 per barrel.
Yeah. Now, and it's now, right now, exactly right now, it's 71.70. See, the good thing is that in the longer term, it will be a problem. In the shorter term, you can gain a lot from it. In the longer term, it's not sustainable, the prices at this point, because there's a lot of oil that is being produced. Saudi Arabia has been selling oil to the Asian countries, especially China, which is the largest exporter of oil from Saudi. They've been selling them at an under market price because they just want to sell and make money. And they did that because OPEC, which is the like alliance of all the oil exporting countries, a lot of players who were part of the OPEC, and allegedly and apparently and according to Saudi, it's Iran and Iraq, they've been selling oil up lower than the market price just to gain a bigger stake in the market. So they were like, okay, if you are doing it, we can play the same game. So the political side of oil prices,
that's dangerous.
Yeah, the political side of oil is very confusing if you go into it and try to understand the pricing.
You know, it's something that specifically stood out to me. It's the fact that the CEO of Aramco, they're paying attention to the emissions that are let out through the use of fossil fuels.
Yeah.
You know, although, you know, oil is a big part of their country's revenue, they're paying attention to that. And, you know, it got me thinking that I think Saudi Arabia has advanced so much, but in terms of sustainability, they have so much more to go. They have so much more to go. Their electrical vehicle market, the electrical vehicle market in Saudi Arabia is still not strong. However, I do think it's going to become stronger because just very recently we saw how Elon Musk opened the first Tesla headquarters in Saudi Arabia. Yeah. And, you know, after Elon's fallout with Donald Trump, you know that he's going to look at new markets and he's going to try and diversify them and spread his product. So I think what I'm looking forward to is seeing how, you know, sustainability specifically is going to develop in Saudi.
And not only Saudi, throughout the world, sustainability was the name of the year 2023 was the sustainability year. 2024 was continued as the sustainability year by UAE, especially.
Who announces these years?
The president himself. So okay. The cabinet, they sit down and they announce it. The funny thing was that after 2 years, as it happened, we saw that so many businesses actually implemented those. They implemented solar panels on their buildings to move away from traditional conventional sources of energy for electricity. The dumping processes, I remember Tetra Pak CEO was here, he told us that the dumping processes became expensive for the companies, so they started reducing their waste, they started recycling their waste. So a lot of those 2 years showed us that a lot can be done. But Aramco CEO, he has a very nice comment that we need to balance it out. You can't completely switch off the grid of conventional energy and just rely on renewable. It doesn't have the capacity right now. Maybe after like 4 or 5 years, maybe AI plays a role in it also, but maybe after 5 years, 10 years, the renewable energy would be enough to run the whole world. But right now, you need it side by side with conventional oil, gas, anything that comes from the ground, the fossil fuels, basically. So he's just claiming that find a sweet balance between renewables and the conventional forms of energy. And wherever that sweet spot is, just use that and make the transition slower. There's another word, energy safety, used in this story. Energy safety is for the countries like your Sudan, Pakistan, the underdeveloped countries or countries which are in conflict. For them, energy security is very important because oil prices go up. The people in those countries suffer the most because their electricity prices go up, their petrol prices go up, and they don't have that buying power that developed countries have. So they have a lot of problems whenever these things happen. Eventually, they suffer. So energy security, and he said that $200 trillion is the total transition cost completely towards renewables. Who will pay that money? That's the question. Who will implement it? That's the question. So there's so many questions attached to it. But I liked his comment that we need to find a good balance right now. You can't completely rely on renewables.
Countries have already been doing that, by the way.
Yeah, everyone
is relying
trying
on
that.
Renewables and non.
Yeah.
I just think that, you know, for Saudi Arabia, that's been an oil-rich nation for so long.
They need to sell oil. That's the thing that one of the main proponents or the main driver behind Saudi Vision 2030 is their oil.
I don't think it's loyalty. I just think it's what they have, you know? It's
a
commodity
it's
that they have.
They have
it's
to sell it to realize Vision 2030. And to be honest, Vision 2030 has a whole branch of sustainability. So they will use oil to realize that vision. But eventually that money,
they
that oil money.
They have been using oil to do so.
They have to. They don't have any other big source of money. So next story up, Gulf Airlines are under growing pressure. Same oil story somehow, as escalating tensions between Israel and Iran lead to widespread fights. But detours are there and sharp rise in fuel costs is there with them. According to AGBI, it was a very nice article yesterday, a lot of numbers in it. Major carriers including Emirates, Etihad, Qatar Airways, Fly Dubai and Air Arabia are now facing significant operational burdens during their busiest season.
So to avoid conflict zones, many European-bound flights are being rerouted through the Red Sea, Egypt and northern Saudi Arabia. So this adds up to 19 minutes of additional flight time per trip. Now for the wide body jets like the Boeing 777 or the A380 flying to the UK, that means up to $6,500 more in fuel costs per flight, amounting to nearly $4 million in added monthly expenses on certain routes.
And the disruption couldn't come at a worse time. It's peak summer, everyone is traveling back home because every kids' yeah. schools are off. People get their off times in this time usually. And it's a traditionally high revenue period for Gulf Airlines, but the rising cost of Brent crude up 1.6%. 74.40 was the number yesterday. Today it came down a little. Right now it's 71.80. It's updating right in front of me per barrel. So it's squeezing margins for the airlines, even with existing fuel hedging strategies in place to manage such volatility.
So the market has already responded. Shares of Jazeera Airways have dropped by 13%, while Air Arabia fell 8%, reflecting investor anxiety. Meanwhile, Wizz Air has suspended some regional routes and restricted overflights across Israeli, Iraqi, Iranian, and Syrian airspace due to safety concerns.
And despite regional instability, Saudi low-cost carrier Flynas is pushing forward versus IPO, which is today. So we'll talk about it as soon as we finish this. But analysts are warning that ongoing geopolitical tensions and fuel price volatility could put future earnings at risk and test the resilience of even the region's strongest aviation players.
Honestly, I feel really bad for the people who are trying to have their summer holiday. You know, the people who worked hard the entire year to just save up that money to go for their holiday. I have many friends whose flights have been canceled, whether to Lebanon, Jordan. I do feel a lot of empathy for them there.
The people who actually booked the flights earlier, before all of this started, they're paying the same amount. They don't have to pay extra premium for all the extra costs that are now attached. One of my wife's friends, she booked a flight to Georgia. It's a 3-hour flight. So 1 month ago, my wife went there. It was a 3-hour flight. For her now, it's a 6-hour flight. But she booked the ticket like earlier, so she didn't have to pay extra before the conflict, before the Israel-Iran conflict began.
So you're telling me that these airlines are charging people extra?
Now, if you book a ticket right now, I think maybe that some of that cost will transfer to the consumer because it has to. But if you had already booked a flight, like people book their week summer getaways like two or one and a half, 2 months before, because they know as the time comes near, the tickets will get expensive. So yeah, people who were like the early bird, they got the worm for cheaper. But now if you look at the tickets, obviously this cost somehow will seep down to the consumer. The good thing about Gulf Airlines is, again, they're an oil-rich nation. All of them are oil-rich nations. They have a lot of, stocks and stocks of oil ready, which has been bought on a cheaper price. But if this Israel-Iran conflict, again, very illegal, very unprovoked by Israel, if this continues for a longer time and there's stockpiles of oil and all that supply somehow finishes, then the oil prices will affect on the consumer as well. So they will have to buy the tickets for maybe a little more. But again,
but imagine,
even more is bad.
How is Flynas going to IPO right now?
Oh yeah, I was looking at Tadawul.
By the way, it's backed by the richest man in the Middle East, the Saudi billionaire Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal. Yeah. And I feel like we've been hearing about their IPO for a while now, since like the beginning of the year. I don't know what they're trying to defy, but I don't think there will be any defiance here.
No. Today they'll open. Tadawul opens a little late because they're 1 hour behind us. So the market is closed right now. Pre-open is there. I'm trying to look if any pre-opening activity is happening on Flynas, but it will open today and we'll see how big it goes, how high it goes. 80 riyals was the rate that they fixed for one share.
They're offering 51.2 million shares right now.
And if it goes above 10%, 15% is the... No, 10% per day is the allowed. So if 80%, 88. If it goes beyond 88 per share, they'll go close trading on it. So every day, for the first 3 days, any stock which IPOs, any company that lists, they're only allowed 10%. Every stock exchange has a different... some of them have a different version. Globally, it's a very common 10% or 15% thing. Let's see. Hopefully, even with the crisis going on, they won't like fall flat on their face. It will be a good IPO. It's the first IPO after like so many years. I remember it's like 20 to 30 years.
That they won't reach their potential.
I think even if they don't do very good, I don't think they'll do very bad, because it's a very exciting IPO. It's the first IPO in like 2 decades for an airline. Jazeera Airways, the one we talked about that lost 13% of its value because of the Israel-Iran conflict, they went down 13%. So it's a bad time, I think. But again, I have hope with Flynas. It's a good carrier. It's a cheap carrier. People are interested in this IPO. So maybe they'll survive, and maybe they'll just stabilize at the 80 point as the Dawal closes today. Let's see. We're hopeful. Yeah. And Al-Waleed bin Talal most probably will be hopeful as well.
And there is a lot of hopeful news. Yeah. Dubai-based developer Bin Ghati Holding has officially launched Bin Ghati Capital, a new Sharia-compliant asset management arm focused on private credit and real estate investments. So the new division signals the company's expansion into the financial services sector.
And Bin Ghati Capital has secured regulatory approval to operate out of the Dubai International Financial Center. Very easy, DIFC. It will cater to institutional investors, that is big companies, high net worth individuals, rich individuals, and family offices. The firm is aiming to manage up to $1 billion in assets through offerings that comply with Islamic finance principles, Sharia compliant, basically.
Now, this strategic move complements Bin Ghati's existing operations in real estate and hospitality, creating a more vertically integrated business model. Now, it also reflects a growing trend among Gulf developers who are increasingly branching out into asset management and financial services.
And the launch aligns with Dubai's broader ambitions to strengthen its position as a global hub for Islamic finance. It's also expected to attract more foreign direct investment, FDI, into the UAE's expanding alternative asset class, particularly in Sharia-compliant instruments.
Now, looking ahead, Bin Ghati Capital will focus on off-plan residential acquisitions and real estate supply chain financing. Now, with nearly 35 billion dirhams in active real estate projects, the company is positioning itself as both a development and financial powerhouse within the region's property sector. Now, with this, you know, with this entire story, Majid, what stood out to me the most is that it is Sharia compliant.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I told you this story before, but I've interviewed Mohammed Bin Ghati.
Yeah,
I remember. Yes,
Sharjah Entrepreneurship.
Yes, yeah. Sharjah Entrepreneurship Festival in the beginning of the year. Yeah. And I remember when I had come up to him, we'd already gotten approval for the interview.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember I was, like, really excited. And I was not thinking past that excitement and that enthusiasm. And I'm like, oh, can we start the interview now? I remember he had said, he was like, can you guys just please wait 5 minutes? I'm just going to go pray. Maghrib.
Yeah.
It was just Maghrib time. Yeah. I believe it was like 7 p.m. And I'll come back. So when I'm reading this, it's like, you know that this is not just done. This is not just done to please the Muslim customers in the UAE.
Yeah.
But it's actually also done out of a firm belief that Sharia compliance is required and it is necessary.
Yeah.
So that really stood out to me.
Yeah, for me it was Katralnada Bin Ghati. So whenever we talk about Bin Ghati, we always talk about Mohammed Bin Ghati, right? And he's the face of the brand, he's everywhere. But our owners shared a very nice LinkedIn post from the CEO at Bin Ghati Holding, and she's Katralnada Bin Ghati, most probably related to the Bin Ghatis. So Ahmed Bin Ghati is going to be the chairman of this new company, Bin Ghati Capital. So how it works is very simple. Bin Ghati Holding is a company. All holding companies are the big, giant umbrella parent company.
Yeah.
And then you have smaller companies or subsidiaries under it. So Bin Ghati Development is one company, and now Bin Ghati Capital. So Bin Ghati, Mohammed Bin Ghati himself is the chairman now.
Mm.
But CEO is a woman, and it's inspiring. I think Wardh will have a comment on it because...
I actually did not know this.
Yeah, but having women CEOs... And this is the first time I knew this. Like, I read it yesterday, and I was like, inspiring. Women leading such a big company, which has like $35 billion dirhams of projects ongoing. Like, they're building those projects. So it's very interesting to see that. More power to women, more CEOs in UAE.
But you know what, my real question is, it's how did Iraqis end up in the UAE? Because
it's a long history.
Mohammed bin Ghati, yes, he is an Emirati, yeah. but they're also Iraqi. So, you know, my question is, why did they specifically choose to move to the UAE?
How did that process happen? When you start the UAE history, whenever you look at it, it starts on pearl trading and this trading, and there's this whole, I forgot the name, it's a path which was used for a lot of pearl trading and a lot of other trading as well. So that path, if you follow it, it goes through a lot of countries in the Middle East, and it crosses Iran, Iraq, goes, touches somewhere near Saudi, goes to Egypt, Silk Route.
I've heard of it before.
Yeah. So the idea, whole history is because of that UAE had very less their own national. Even now, they have like 10-15% of their own Emirati people. But a lot of people in that time, when it was a desert and there was nothing, and all the states were separate. At that time, a lot of people moved here because they saw something, they wanted to trade something, they came and stayed. So a lot of Iraqis came, a lot of Irani people I've seen, Emiratis, Pakistani. It's a very weird story. So there's this part in Pakistan which is towards the border of Balochistan and Sindh. So we call them Balochis because Balochistan.
Balochis, you mean?
Some people
find that term offensive.
Yeah, I've never realized, but it's a very common second name.
It's common, but I would not suggest to use
it. But so in Pakistan, we have a province called Balochistan.
And no, I mean here, by the way.
No, not Balochi, it's Balochi. So
I think, in Arabic, we say Balochi.
Yeah, because you don't have the ch letter. But the thing is that a lot of people... So there was slave trade that happened on the borders of Pakistan when Pakistan was not Pakistan, obviously, and our neighbors were not Afghanistan. It was a whole thing. So a lot of people moved from Africa there, you know, slave trade, which was the worst thing in the history of humanity. A lot of slaves came, they settled there, and then they were bought by a lot of people who brought them to different parts of the world. So there's a lot of people who actually moved from there to the UAE, to this region, specifically Middle East.
You know what it also is, Majid?
It's a very complicated history.
I remember reading somewhere, his name, it's on my mind, he's a part of DP World, but he was talking about the Jabal Ali Free Zone. And the Jabal Ali Free... I'll tell you why I'm specifically mentioning the Jabal Ali Free Zone. It's because of the fact that in the UAE, you know, a lot of these families, like the Bin Ghati family, they come here because you can come to something like the Jabal Ali Free Zone and you have these tax incentives and you have 100%, you know, ownership. The fact that in itself is possible, of course they would come here. And I believe with Iraq, I feel that this is constantly overlooked, but they have had a lot of situations over the year. 2003, didn't the U.S. invaded Iraq?
Yeah,
in the 1960s, they had this nationalistic revolution in Baghdad.
Yeah.
So and you know what's so interesting, Majid? It's the fact that, by the way, you know that the Iraqi government, bringing us back to the topic we were talking about, oil and, you know, the complete dependence on it, more than 90% of the Iraqi government's revenue comes from oil, by the way.
It is said that America basically invaded Iraq as soon as Saddam Hussein revolted against them, that I won't sell oil to you for cheaper. And they said there's weapons of mass destruction. And there's so many stories about the American invasions in so many countries.
And they call it democratic.
And they're like, oh, we're fighting for democracy. But for 30, 40 years, those people were ruling.
They're fighting for money.
And you never said anything. And then randomly one day you were like, oh, we'll fight for democracy and invade. Looks weird. The logic doesn't logic. So, yeah. The idea is that UAE, when you go back into history... I think I remember a book. It's called The Indus Valley Civilization by some author. I completely forgot. I read it very long back. But it has this one small part which tells you that some of the Indus Valley Civilization, which is very famous in Asian region, some of it also seeped here. So culturally, we have some common things because of the Indus Valley Civilization in the Middle East, which came from Asia. So you read that in part and you're like, how complicated is it? Like American European historians, you see they're like, just take an example of Europe, for example. Consider Middle East like Europe. European countries, you have so many common things, but they speak their own languages and everything is there. Likewise, UAE, Middle East was itself like Europe at some point. Everyone was separated. But now the crucial states, all seven of them, came together, made UAE. Saudi Arabia somehow became Saudi Arabia. Egypt has been Egypt for a long time. It has a long history of civilization. But yeah, a lot of people here that you look at who have Emirati citizenship, they belong to a lot of areas from Asia, from here and there.
It's just so interesting how you can move one business to another. For me, what I'm so curious about is...
I don't think they were in Iraq. They were working in Iraq, like Bengalis?
I'm not sure whatsoever, but
if I do meet him
again, I will definitely ask him that. But I think with businesses, do you think that it's difficult to move businesses from one country to the next?
That difficult in the modern time. It's very easy. You just come to free trade zones are like good, but they're very good if you want to set up a company which exports something to someplace else. So if you have, for example, you're an Indian company, you have clothing business and you send it to Europe, you have a market there. UAE becomes, and the free trade zone becomes a very nice zone. You come in, you throw your stuff there. You don't have to pay. Literally, you dump all of it, like store it. A good word is store it there. And you don't have to pay any taxes because you're just putting it there. And then from there, it will move to Europe. So it helps you make a very nice central position. Again, Middle East and UAE are the center of the world.
And you know why I asked you that specifically, Majid? Because basically what happened in Sudan is after the entire ongoing civil war, a lot of people moved their businesses.
Yeah.
They either still operate near Port Sudan. Port Sudan right now is one of the safest places in Sudan. But, you know, they moved their businesses, and they specifically moved their businesses to Egypt.
Yeah.
That's where they specifically moved. Even here, by the way, Sudanese people, they moved their businesses to Ajman. A lot of people moved there. And what I noticed is a lot of these businesses were hospitality businesses, by the way.
Nice.
Like, for example, in Egypt, that the story of Biscoid Baraka by the Sa'id company, they didn't open a new factory, but rather they outsourced it so they could produce their biscuits in that company. And then there was this other company that I just randomly discovered, Majid. It's called the Nutella Bar. And Majid, their ice cream looks so delicious. Did you watch the videos that I was sending? It looks like cake. It looks like cake. Basically, it's like ice cream. It's specialty ice cream like tiramisu, cheesecake, Dubai chocolate. But it's like shaped like a cake. And they put all the toppings that they would put on a cake. They don't crush it like you would usually do an ice cream.
Yeah.
So point is, I'm reading the comment section. Every single comment section, people are like, oh my God, we are going to support this Egyptian business more because it's Sudanese. And I'm like, are you people making this up? And then I read one comment where a girl was like, I remember trying this business in Sudan. And the actual account, the company account, responded saying, yes, we are Sudanese. And out of nowhere, I go and I open Bleben's Saudi Arabian TikTok. It's the same ice cream.
Yeah.
They completely imitated it.
Yeah.
So I think... Gave it a new name, exactly. I don't know what the name is, but it's interesting because it's like, honestly, if you move your business from one country to the other and someone copies you, you know you did a good job.
Yeah.
If someone is imitating you,
it's the same across industries. WhatsApp, Telegram, all these things. At the end of the day, what do? They let you message one person.
Didn't Pavel Durov say that WhatsApp copied 80% of Telegram?
The thing is, businesses is, the best way to do a business is find something in country where it is working, and then find a country where that product is not there, pick up the idea, localize it, and put it in that country. So that's the best, easiest way to start a business. If you see something in Romania, very randomly came to my mind, and you see that it's there, but it's not anywhere else, just pick it up. So I think someone went to Sudan, saw the cake, and were like,
They opened in Egypt. Due to the ongoing civil war,
so they themselves opened.
They relocated their business to Egypt, and the store is very, very famous. It has a long line.
Yeah.
So I see why they imitated it. But, you know, speaking of Telegram, WhatsApp, Iranian state television is urging citizens to delete WhatsApp, specifically accusing the app of collecting user data and sharing it with Israel. Now, the claim follows Israel's recent unprovoked attack on Iranian territory, but Iranian media has not provided any concrete evidence to support the allegations.
Meanwhile, WhatsApp, which is owned by the Meta Platforms and overseen by CEO Mark Zuckerberg, has strongly denied the accusations. In a public statement, the company said it does not track users' messages or locations. It also warned that such false claims could be used to justify future attempts to block the app within Iran.
Now, this isn't the first time Iran has taken aim at Western tech platforms. During the 2022 protests over the death of an Iranian woman in morality police custody, the Iranian government banned WhatsApp and restricted access to Google Play. Now, those bans were only lifted in late 2024.
And Meta's ongoing tensions with spyware-related threats also add context to the current situation. In December, Meta won a $168 million dollar ruling against Israeli surveillance firm NSO Group. The company had illegally exploited a WhatsApp vulnerability, a bug, to install spyware on users' devices, demonstrating that even encrypted platforms can be compromised.
I think that this story is crazy, Majid, because you have Iranian state television that is coming. They're alleging that, you know, WhatsApp, it's taking their data and it's giving it to Israel. So how does that make Mark Zuckerberg look? And especially for Mark Zuckerberg, by the way, who, by the way, you know the lawsuit with NSO, it was specifically their Pegasus software, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
Majid, that entire court case was like over 5 years. So you're telling me, Zuckerberg, that you took Israeli spyware firm NSO on a court, on an entire court fight for over 5 years because they've been hacking WhatsApp allegedly to spy on, I believe, journalists.
Yeah.
And then you turn around after you win over $160 million and you're allegedly now using the actual, like, WhatsApp user data to give it to Israel? This does not make sense to me. Like, this is a complete dichotomy. Like, you fought for your right, your independence to not be spied on, but you're spying on people, allegedly.
But Iranian state media has said this. They claim it's being done. Meta says they're not doing it. The truth, maybe after 5 years, it will come out when some papers are unsealed or something. The only story, the only angle out of this is that technology, the way that it has like taken over our lives, it's very easy for anyone to track literally anyone. For example, on Instagram, whenever you're at a place, you're putting up your location. If you have an Instagram public account, they're always like, oh, I'm here enjoying the ice cream. You're literally telling the whole world publicly on a public platform with a public profile.
People have died because of this, by the way.
Yeah, so all of this, it's just at the individual level, at every person's level, you should be careful. But if you live in a country like UAE or to an extent Saudi also, Qatar, they are safe places to an extent. Not to an extent, a lot, to be honest. After like looking at the world, these countries are better for
social media.
Just be careful with your social media. There's a whole movement going on right now in Europe and America where children's picture online, they've been turned into so many hideous things. There's a whole documentary on children being YouTube stars, earning millions for their parents, and then being exploited by the marketing agencies or the people who represented them. So this whole conversation is going on. Reminds me of one post that we did. We talked about the AI in schools. There was a post that I did of AI in schools. And I was trying not to use children's picture because it was AI in schools. And obviously, who's in school? Children. So I found this very nice picture from COVID times where the then Minister of Education, he was there. He was wearing a mask and all the kids were wearing a mask. And one of the people commented on it that, why did you put this old picture? COVID is over and this and that. And I told him my reasoning that I was trying to hide their faces and I found a picture where I can show the kids without their faces. So it was a nice move. And he was like, yeah, I would have never thought of that. Because again, putting up children's pictures, it's tricky. We hosted a lot of kids for ODM,
industry.
Remember? And a lot of people, their parents didn't give them permission. So I think the idea has developed in parents' brain that you don't have to put everything on social media. It's a scary tech world. Not scaremongering again, but the idea is that just try to be safe. Have parental controls on apps whenever you're telling your son to play anything. I remember one of my friends in Saudi Arabia when I was there, both of them are friends, so she and he, they have a daughter who's like 7 or 8 years old, and she used to play Roblox a lot. So, and they were like, due to peer pressure, her whole class plays Roblox, and she's not there because we didn't give her a screen and we didn't allow her to play the game. So they wanted her to be included in that peer group, right? She wanted to play Roblox. So they put up so many parental controls. They fixed a time for her. So it's just an extra effort that parents sometimes have to do in this technology full era.
Yeah.
You have to just be a little more vigilant, and put in a little more effort into seeing what your son is watching or what your daughter is watching on YouTube. Specifically YouTube Kids.
But I just want to add this in, you know, with like Mark Zuckerberg, you know, father of Meta.
I just, with
this entire story, do keep in mind that it is not confirmed.
Yeah.
There was no evidence that came forward. Yeah. But let me tell you what Bassem Youssef had to say about it. He said, I said earlier that Mark Zuckerberg, one of the top Mossad agents in the world, sends information and coordinates of users to the Mossad, and this happened in targeting Lebanon and Gaza. Now, I remember a while ago, I remember Microsoft was under fire for this, but Majid, do you remember if Meta was too in the finding of coordinated targets to drop bombs in
no,
Lebanon?
No, Meta hasn't been.
I'm not sure if it's been mentioned.
Meta basically is a platform company, which has platforms, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp. Microsoft is a software developer. So Microsoft, I remember, forgot the name of the page. It's a very interesting... No Azure for Apartheid. Yeah, that page. So there's a software, Azure, that Microsoft created. It helps you geolocate or do a lot of stuff. Their claim is they sold it to Israel, and you can't control the use. You can just send them a legal document that this is the software, this is what you can use it for. It's like selling a knife. A hawker sells you a knife. What you do with the knife is not the responsibility of the hawker. You asked for the knife, you paid 10 dirhams, he sold you the knife. Now the hawker can't come to your house and be like, are you cutting an apple or are you killing someone? So that's the logic that Microsoft has given.
And but the logic is completely wrong, by the way.
No, this logic is... Logically, it's
they're
right.
They're evading responsibility. They're evading
it's
public...
It's not evading responsibility.
It is evading responsibility.
See, legally, logically, it makes sense. The problem is, the actual problem is that the Microsoft employees, all of those who are part of Azure for Apartheid, they are claiming, and it's their claim, not like a verified claim, they are claiming that when Israel was being sold the software by Microsoft, Microsoft knew what they were going to use it for. So there's two sides of the story. There's Microsoft claiming that we sold the knife, we don't know what Israel does with it because we can't control that. The employees are coming out and they're saying, no, Microsoft knows. Microsoft sold this software on the idea that Israel will use it for this. So you can't verify those claims. That's the problem with all of this.
I see what both sides are, but we have seen what's been going on for the last three years, what Israel is doing to Palestinians, what it's doing to Gaza. It's a genocide, and it is public news. It is absolutely everywhere. So I don't think they can, even if they wanted to, I don't think they can play the card of we were unaware.
Again, they can't. I'll give you a small example. Oppo, for example, this is my phone, is Oppo, yours is iPhone. If you start using your iPhone for some illegal thing, will the guillotine fall on Apple? Is Apple responsible? No. Likewise, Microsoft created a software. They sold it. Whatever you do with that software, they can't control it. That's the problem, and that's the logic that Microsoft uses. And to be honest, on legal basis, on logical basis, they're completely right. Again, the problem is the people are claiming who worked for Azure, who helped build that software, that when the deal was being made to sell that software to Israel, it was clearly mentioned by Israeli IDF, basically, and Israeli Defense Forces, that we will use it for this purpose. And Microsoft was like, we're selling the software. we don't care what you do with it. So that is the claim made by the employees. Again, it's very complicated when you go into the legality, the logic of it, the technicalities of it. But the employees are claiming they made Azure. Maybe they are right. Again, after 10 years, maybe someday some report will reveal that it happened or it didn't happen. We'll wait for that and we'll keep you updated on it.
Yes, we will.
That is what we're doing at Smashy Business.
Yeah. And that's a wrap for today. Thank you so much for tuning into the Smashy Business Show. Make sure to follow us across all social media channels at Smashy Business and stay ahead with our daily newsletter. You'll find the subscription link in the description.
This has been a Smashy Business Show, a Smashy Business production, part of the Augustus Media Podcast Network. A big shout out to our 1.5 million monthly listeners across all platforms. I confirmed it 2 days ago. It's 1.5. So thank you so much. You make this possible. If you're one of them, we appreciate you. Have a great day. See you tomorrow.